Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Time for the Friday Gathering, and I'm joined in the studio by Malcolm Byrne, Fianna Fáil Senator from Wexford, Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD from Dublin South Central, Fionnán Sheehan, Ireland Editor at the Irish Independent, and Mark Paul, who's Business Columnist with the Irish Times. You're all very welcome. Thank you for being here. We'll start with Robert Troy, a colleague of yours, Malcolm. How did you react and how do you respond today to his resignation?
Good morning, Clare. Well, Robert is a friend of mine, and I think he's a very good, hardworking TD. He was a very good minister, particularly on trade and dealing with stuff like the Digital Services Act, how we're preparing for artificial intelligence. That said, what he did was wrong. He acknowledged that. He's paid the price for it. It wasn't excusable not filling in the SIPO declaration.
Not according to the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste.
I think in fairness, when Robert came out first, he acknowledged that he made a series of mistakes. I think he probably should have come out earlier and done that tell-all interview and outlined everything that happened. The fact that information continued to drip out, added to the problems. But look, what Robert did was wrong. I'm not making excuses for that. He's acknowledged that himself. He's apologised for that. He's taken a course of action. And in the context, it was probably the right course of action.
Was it inevitable as the week went on, did you think?
I think it probably was. I mean, there's the old Alistair Campbell line that if a story is still a story 11 days after it started, it inevitably wants it to be killed.
Because Fionnán's colleagues report today, John Downing on the front of the Irish Independent, that Fianna Fáil backbenchers are dismayed at the way the matter was allowed to drag on for 2 weeks. And this refers to Micheál Martin's handling of this and the support that he showed. And the comparison, of course, is how he dealt with Barry Cowan and how he dealt with Derek O'Leary, both very swiftly.
Yeah, I think it was a case that, when the issues came to light at the start and Robert then made a series of amendments, obviously, to his declaration, the problem was that wasn't the end of it.
Mm-hmm. But is there dismay amongst Fianna Fáil backbenchers?
I wouldn't say dismay. Dismay is the sort of thing that sub-editors like putting into newspaper headlines. There's obviously disappointment that this has happened. There is a clear acknowledgement. No one is making excuses for Robert. On a personal level, people feel sympathy for him because he is a decent politician. It's not that...
It's more, I think, the dismay, though, is around Micheál Martin's handling of it.
I mean, the Taoiseach obviously responded on the basis of, the information that Robert put out there. More and more information came out. Robert took a decision then to resign. You can always engage in a lot of, what if Robert had come out much earlier and outlined...
But you don't think there's questions for Micheál Martin? I
don't think so. Okay. I mean, I think, the Taoiseach showed loyalty to Robert, expecting that everything would come out. Clearly, as more and more information emerged, Robert knew that his position wasn't tenable and in the circumstances resigned.
So Fionnán, your colleagues are hearing that this is bad news for Micheál Martin.
Well, it's good to hear that Malcolm is a friend who sympathises with Robert Troy, because that wasn't the universal view, you'd have to say, within Fianna Fáil. There was some TDs who were less than sympathetic towards his plight and the fact that he ultimately had to resign, and that's before you even get on to Micheál Martin's handling of this. Ultimately, Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar end up on the wrong side of the fence on this one, because they get outflanked by the kind of the South County Dublin Brigade of the coalition. You started it here now with Josefa Madigan the other day, who wasn't here to either defend or prosecute. Well, that was the start, in that the response came from Eamon Ryan only 2 hours later. Up until that point, everybody within the coalition was generally supportive. Suddenly you go from a Fine Gael minister saying she's not either defending nor prosecuting him, and then there's a Green Party minister from the same part, geographical part of the country, whose party colleague would be quite competitive with Josefa Madigan, and he was calling for a triple whammy investigation here. So that did seem to be the beginning of the end for Robert Troy. Didn't help himself by the fact that there's a kind of a political rule about if you do a a tell-all, answer-all, clarify-all interview, you better not have another half dozen questions coming at you half an hour later, and that's where Robert Troy ended up here.
Mm-hmm. And Breed Smith, there was a big conversation yesterday on Liveline after Robert Troy's statement the night before about his assertion that landlords were being vilified and that he was being vilified by some for being a landlord. Do you think that's fair?
No, I don't. No, I think that's ridiculous, and it's a mechanism of defence on his part that doesn't stand up. There's a very interesting article by Dermot Ferreter in this morning's Irish Times, yeah. And he points out 37% of all Oireachtas members are landlords, and that's way out of kilter with the general population, which is about 3% of the population are private landlords. But the basic point he makes, and one we've repeatedly made, is that there is a problem here, that vested interests sit around the table and design policy and pass laws or object to laws like freezing rents, like banning evictions at a time of the most serious historical housing crisis in the country.
But those people are elected, and the people who elect them should know what their interests are. That's why we have standards in policy. Public office,
yeah, but
and
they don't put on
interest.
Their election literature, elect me because I have 11 properties, most of which are rented back to the state, and I'm able to flip properties at a whim and over 3 months make a lot of money on them. That's not on the election literature. That comes out in the SEPO forms, should come out in the SEPO forms ultimately. But there is a problem with the preponderance of landlordism in Dáil Éireann while we're in a housing crisis and while laws are being blocked, progressive laws that could freeze rents, that could stop evictions in certain cases. And nobody seems to be talking about that. He made an apology for filling out the forms wrong, for not declaring a property to the RTB, that he made mistakes. But he doesn't see, and neither does Micheál Martin or Leo Varadkar, a problem in the actual makeup of what is landlordism within Dáil Éireann.
Mark Paul, what do you say to all that?
Look, undoubtedly, Robert Troy's shortcomings in his SIPO filings, that was the stake in this story. But the sizzle, the heat really was, I think, around the fact that he was a landlord. That was a lot of the attention on social media, a lot of the pressure came upon him. And look, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a landlord. There's nothing wrong with being a landlord with 11 properties. I'm not sure I'd agree with Breed that it's a problem to have landlords in Dáil Éireann. If it was, you would have a whole series of laws that were totally skewed in favour of landlords. And then, well, why are landlords fleeing the market? I mean, landlords have been fleeing the market since about for the last 6 or 7 years. The government is trying to come up with ways to bring landlords back into the market. So if it was a total, you know, landlord-dominated parliament, you'd have a whole load of laws in favour of small landlords, and they have to pay. The rules are against them when it comes to tax on passive income, and a lot of laws that are weighted against small landlords.
The evidence doesn't bear out your argument.
I don't think
that's what
Paul
is saying.
In the case of Robert Troy, it does. He had 11 properties, most of which were rented back to the state, and he was able to flip a property and sell it back to the state within a matter of months. And I think there's probably more of this that goes on, but we don't
delve
down into it.
If Mark's point is, if the Dáil is weighted in favour of landlords, then landlords wouldn't be leaving the market, small landlords, because it would be an attractive place for them to be.
But it is an attractive place to be a landlord. There's other reasons why they're leaving the market. And most of it is to do with the sort of responsibility on them and the pressure on them. When they own properties, to keep them in a certain, to keep them in according to the law. But what you do have is the big landlords are muscling in. The REITs and the developers and the vulture funds who are buying up multiple properties, they're muscling in and getting all the benefits.
So first of all, there is nothing wrong with being a landlord. And I think we do need to get that message out there. 70% of landlords in this country own only one property. 82% own only one or two properties. So most landlords are small landlords in this country. The overwhelming majority of landlords are good landlords. The overwhelming majority of tenants are good tenants. There are bad landlords and there are bad tenants. And I know Joe Duffy has been just discussing that.
To clarify my point, I am not saying there's a problem with being a landlord. I'm saying there's a problem with the preponderance of landlords in the Oireachtas who sit down and make policy and pass laws or object to laws around a housing crisis, which has never been worse in the history of the state.
But I accept that. But the issue there is around getting supply, and that's about ensuring that we maximise the supply of housing out there. It is the biggest domestic crisis. But part of the solution of that is to try to keep landlords in the market. And to Mark's point...
Keep them in the doll.
No. To keep landlords out there to be able to ensure that for them, okay, that they are able to stay in the market. And Mark is right. A lot of the smaller landlords are leaving. It's one of the issues we're trying to address in the budget. I think vilifying existing landlords doesn't
it's
help.
That's what I'm doing.
What do we want here, Brie? Do we want a quota on the number of TDs that are allowed to own property? Because that seems to be where we're going here. These people are democratically elected. If the business that they happen to be in is around owning property or owning houses, well, then so be it. The electorate decided that these people should be their chuck-dee dollar. If they're not happy with them because of the business that they're in, well, they can vote them out at the next election. It's simple as that. I've never seen... somebody can cite an example to me of somebody being... voted out simply because they owned a number of houses. It doesn't really spring
well, look,
to mind.
I mean, I'll just say this.
So we're basically saying as well, so farmers should not have any role whatsoever in agricultural policy. Doctors should have no role whatsoever in health policy.
That's absolutely nonsense.
No, you said that people who want properties shouldn't be involved in housing policy.
No, I didn't. I said there's a problem with the preponderance of landlords in the Europe.
What is your solution to it? Because these people, we, the public, are entitled to elect people. You seem to be trying to dictate to people what sort of people they're allowed to elect.
Personally, I think they should declare all their interests when they run for election, not after they're elected.
That makes sense. That does make sense.
There's a lot of people who don't put a lot of stuff on their
literature, such as people who go around saying they're in favour of housing, but then object to every housing development in their constituency. I'd like to see that on election literature. Strangely enough, I don't tend to see that happening.
I'm talking about actual ownership and representation.
I think the key in coming out of this is there is a need, and I know this is something Mike McGrath's committed to, a reform of the SIPO legislation. I mean, the form, which everyone knows who fills it in, I remember as a member of the local of a local authority, it's been essentially the same paper-based form since it came in. I would like to
see
pretty
simple
situation
to understand, is it?
Yeah. Well, there are elements of confusion which do come out about, and I'm not going to go into the areas on that, but I think what we do need is a dynamic system whereby all of us as public representatives can upload all of, you know, our information. I'm not a landlord. I tend to overcompensate when I'm, you know, filling in the detail on the form. You don't even have to declare your person residence. I tend to do it. But I think it should be a dynamic computer-based system that anybody can access to see, you know,
so
anybody's
are you saying
particular
it's,
interests.
It's overly complicated now for politicians?
No, it's not overly complicated. I think, though, that what should happen is that we need a system whereby it can be filled in online rather than the paper-based system that we have at the moment. There is a need for some clarity around, for instance, if you are a landlord and you're in receipt of either a HAP payment or a ROS payment, because there was some confusion around that. But in general terms, and let's be clear about this, there is a very clear requirement. The reporting period is for the annual year, the 1st of January
and
to the 31st
very
of
clear.
December.
That's
that is very clear.
Clear.
That's what Robert Troy got wrong and what was acknowledged.
That's what brings me back to why the Taoiseach and the Housing Minister, actually, Darragh O'Brien, supported him in the way that he did when the rules are so clear on this. I mean, just a basic reading for somebody coming to it first time, you can see how easy it is to get it right. I don't understand why they didn't check with him, you know, is everything in order before we come out fully in support of you? And what does it say about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, because the Taoiseach offered similar support, that they just said, he's grand, he's top class, everything is fine, there's nothing to see here.
I don't think that was the question. I think there was an acknowledgement that what Robert Troy did was wrong. What they said was in his performance of ministerial duties that he was a top-class minister, which he was. That doesn't take away from the fact that what he did was wrong.
And he broke the law.
He amended his declaration when it was obviously by journalists who brought it into the public domain. I think the difficulty was that there was other stuff that then subsequently started to emerge.
Yeah, it's just, I'm going back to what Fintan O'Toole wrote on Tuesday, you know. If you can do what he did and say, I'm sorry about that, it was a mistake, it makes a mockery of the protections that we have. when it comes to standards in public life.
You would have liked to have seen the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach put a much greater emphasis on following the rules and the consequences for breaking the rules in their original statements. I mean, like, this is the world of politics. In the world of business, the root of all evil in the world of business is a lax attitude to corporate governance and corporate rules. Every business scandal that we've ever had in Ireland has always come from people having a casual attitude to rules. And when that starts to leak into politics and to declaring interests and so on, if you allow a culture of that to build up, you'll eventually end up with the same scandals in politics that we've had in business.
So in supporting Robert Troy, was the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach condoning lax standards when it comes to standards in public office?
I don't know if they were condoning. They certainly weren't placing enough emphasis on the fact that there should be ramifications if you break those rules. And that should have been the top line on their statement. And then maybe after that, they can say what a top-class ministry is and try and save their man then. But they've got to send out the message, you know, loud and clear and wide to everybody that you can't break the rules. And if you break the rules, there has to be consequences.
Like,
there has to be a culture of that.
That's why your party's going to ship some damage from this.
Yeah, I mean, that is understandable. Look, what Robert did was wrong. He has paid the price for doing that.
Has he?
I think it is. Well, he's resigned as minister. I think there is, yes, and this comes to the point that when somebody is elected, that everything should be declared. And I would like to see a situation whereby, you know, every politician and political party outlines very clearly, you know, all of the properties that they own or in which they have an interest, that should be clearly out there when the electorate, where well, all sources
Breed
of funding.
Breed had a very good point there that perhaps those filings should be filled out by every candidate, not just everyone, by every candidate.
I think that, I mean, that's certainly an option that it could be done. I mean, I'm not opposed to the idea that if we do it, and again, if it's done in a way whereby it can be filled in online when you're seeking to run. But it shouldn't be a barrier, and I agree with Finan on this, it shouldn't be a barrier that if we have somebody who happens to be a property owner, a landlord, they shouldn't be discouraged from running from election.
This is one point, Claire. The optics of this, for the people who sit in front of my clinic twice a week and are terrified of losing their home because they're being evicted on whatever grounds, or they can't get a HAP tenancy, or the rent has gone so high that they can't pay it. The optics of this is shocking. And people see this as politicians looking after themselves in the middle of a housing crisis. Politicians, overwhelmingly the Dáil and the Seanad, has way too many landlords representing the interests of landlords. And that should be flagged up to the people in advance of an election.
But if you look at Robert Troy, I mean, one of the points is he was a landlord who accepted HAP payments and Ross payments, which, as you know, not all landlords will do that. The evidence is that he was a good landlord. The problem was, and I'm not getting away from this,
he failed. You know, he's still getting paid the rent that he's charging.
I entirely accept that. The problem was he didn't complete the forms which he should have done in a particular way.
And he failed to register with the RTB a particular property.
Okay, well, we move on because we were talking at the start of the programme about a windfall tax. We don't have one here. And there's an argument for and there's an argument against. But facing into the winter that we're facing, Mark, you might start us off on this. Calls are likely to grow. It seems that the Green Party leader is in favour, at least, of examining this very closely. Will it work?
It won't generate huge amounts of money. And I think a lot of it is about political optics. Windfall taxes really work when they're targeted at the producers, the guys who are drilling the stuff out of the ground.
And we can't get at them in the main.
Well, we've banned the entire industry. We don't have an exploration industry in Ireland. We've banned it. You know, you've got the Corrib gas field, which will run out in about 6 or 7 years' time. And after that, we've got nothing. And the Green Party and the Minister for the Environment, Eamon Ryan, are dragging their heels on the ones that do have licences. But look, windfall taxes work best on these big producers, your Exxons, your BPs, your Shells, those kind of companies. Windfall taxes on retail energy companies, I mean, they have to buy their energy on the market. They're price takers. But they're still making very, very big profits. But the biggest retail energy company in the state is state owned. So you're putting a windfall tax on a company that could just pay you a dividend. Now look, it might capture smaller companies, the likes of Bord Gáis Energy, which is owned by Centrica, a UK company, or the likes of Energia. And they're making record profits, but you're not going to generate enough cash off a windfall tax from those companies to keep the problem at bay for people.
Tony Foley made the point earlier on, Bree, that it's about social cohesion. It's about sharing the burden.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't hear the piece earlier on. Apologies, I missed that. But I understand one of the speakers said you'd only get about €150 per household back out of a windfall tax. Now,
that's on a very specific example, I think, when it came to Bord Gáis, if you take the number of customers
and
their profits.
That's right, it was Bord Gáis. Now, that might sound like a small amount in the bigger scheme of things, but I can tell you there are tens of thousands of households who'd welcome €150 back off their gas bill. And in our pre-budget submission, we're advocating a 50% windfall tax on the energy companies, which would only bring, and it's not a king's ransom, €300 million, according to the figures we got back from the department. But nevertheless, that's €300 million that would help to alleviate the energy crisis for ordinary people, for families and workers who are really, really suffering and terrified with the winter coming in the prices escalating.
You don't agree with that, Malcolm?
Well, I thought the debate that you had at the top of the programme and I listened to it was quite interesting. I think, you know, the easy solution is to say, let's put a windfall tax. And Mark is right, you know, on these companies. We can't really tax the producers. What we've got to ensure in that, in any measure that we take, you know, what are the consequences of that? And I think if it in any way inhibits investment in infrastructure, and because we need investment in grid and in energy supply, or if it in any way means that costs are going to be passed on to the consumer, we've got to avoid that. I think your panelists at the start said, I'm not opposed to the idea if it makes sense that it does show a level of social solidarity.
Yeah.
I think what is important then as well is we've the short-term solution. I think we've also got to look at the longer-term solutions, because we are going to see high energy prices for as long as Putin's war continues. These are going to be challenges. We need to ensure that we invest in renewables, particularly offshore energy. That means speeding up the planning process around that and solar.
What about storing gas at Shannon?
I think we may need to consider it. This is a difficult issue. I think we do need to move as quickly away from fossil fuels as possible. But in the short term, that may be one of the only solutions that we have. I think there are concerns, obviously, this winter around our capacity. We don't want to see blackouts that are there. There are certainly concerns on prices. I mean, I'm talking to businesses at the moment who are renewing their electricity bills, and you're seeing double and triple digit increases. And the fear there is that that's going to be passed on to consumers in terms of on pricing. So it's not opposing it. I think the key is around how can we, for the consumer, ensure that one, that they have a reliable supply of electricity. That means investment in infrastructure, which is what I prefer to see the ESB and companies do. And then secondly, apart from reliable supply, that in as far as possible we manage to keep costs down.
Because your government's facing a really tricky winter, and yes, the arms are open to the data centres. Come here, we'll give you all the energy that you need. Set up your diesel generator there to help you out if you get stuck.
Well, I think if you look at where the changes are happening on planning, is for any of the new data centres, it's about ensuring that they're energy self-sufficient. And it's a tricky balancing act. I mean, there are people who will, again, a bit like the landlord's question, present data centres as evil. Yet, you know, the Irish economy cannot function without those data centres.
Well, the people, Fionnán, who are being asked not to use their washing machine between 5 and 7 and maybe delay your dinner until 8 o'clock and the children are all very tired, might rightly question why we welcome so many data centres to the country.
Because we get one in every €4 that we spend in from corporation taxes, and one in every 8 comes from just 10 companies at the top, some of whom are the biggest users of data centres. So that's the payoff. And we seem to want to have it both ways in this country. We want multinational, we want to be an open economy where multinationals come here, they avail of our tax or our skills or our base within the European Union, whichever it may be. But on the flip side then, we don't want to deal with things such as the housing problems that are associated with bringing in additional workers into the country. We don't want to deal with the energy spikes that they deliver. So we literally can't have it both ways. Yeah, a windfall tax will address the problem of that issue of large energy companies profiting off the back of a rise in prices. But on the big issue emerging now is around energy security. So it's good. The only good thing I've seen come out of the last 10 days is the appointment of the former SecGen of the Department of the Taoiseach to do a non-ideological review of our energy policy in this country. So stripping out all the politics out of it and getting down to the reality of what we actually need to do. Mm-hmm.
Can I just come in here? Because, look, I've listened all week to a narrative that we have a looming energy crisis is going to be blackouts this winter and we weren't warned about it. This is nonsense. I mean, I heard Timmy Dooley on your programme during the week saying we were never warned about this. Now, I was kind of worried about his health because I was at the same meetings he was at. And he seems to have complete blackout in his memory about the fact that Crewe and Air Grid did sit in front of our committee many times and warn about the crisis that we're facing in terms of power. And they also pointed the finger at the proliferation of data centres. And this is not saying that we don't need data centres, that we couldn't be on a Zoom call or watch Netflix or something. That nobody is rubbishing data centres or totally rubbishing landlords. But there needs to be a proportion on this. And I was recently informed in a parliamentary question that we are about to connect another 8 mega data centres to the national grid in the next 2 years. Another 8 of them. And they will consume 1.5 kilowatts of energy, which is like totally disproportionate to what needs to be done.
I've always seen data centres as kind of the rough with the smooth. It's kind of, there's almost an unwritten agreement, I think, between the government and a lot of the big tech companies that, look, we'll bring you the big snazzy glass buildings full of thousands of workers down in the Docklands, but, you know, you've also got to accept our data centres kind of as part of the deal. And I think there's been a kind of an understanding between the government and the likes of Amazon and Apple, which tried to put one in Athenry. Data centres don't bring a lot of jobs.
When
once they're set up. 20 or 30 people working in it uses shed loads of power. And they really, really put a strain on it. And Air Grid has been warning about data centres since about 2017. It started to become a problem about 10 years ago. They don't bring huge amounts of employment and investment. But it's something that kind of Ireland has to put up with, I think, if we want to be the sort of best boy in the class when it comes to getting the other sort of investments
on those companies. On our climate change policy as well, we've got a new runway at Dublin Airport. I mean, does that make a mockery of our climate action plan?
Well, look, it certainly doesn't embellish it. It's interesting to see a new runway at Dublin Airport. Look, they've been talking about it for, I don't know, 50 or 60 years. I got planning permission 15 years ago. Look, Ireland, as everybody knows, obviously is an island and aviation is very important. We all know that. But aviation, I believe, is going to come fundamentally under more and more pressure over coming years as other types of carbon emissions or industries emitting carbon, as they sort of do what they can over years, the relative importance of aviation in terms of emissions is going to become more, and pressure will come more and more on Ireland to cut emissions on that. And you kind of wonder how a new runway at the airport, which will raise the number of flights by about a third, I think, over coming years, it's just going to bring more and more pressure on the sector in Ireland. And Ireland will eventually have to make a decision. Is this one sector that we just have a special set of rules for that we just can't cut emissions?
Is it, Malcolm?
Well, it is, but we are, as Mark said, we're an island, we rely on connectivity, and there is going to be pressure on the air transport sector, like on the transport sector and every other, to reduce our emissions. I think part of that is going to come about through new technologies. For instance, Airbus has already committed that by 2050 that all of its operations will be carbon neutral. It's looking at hydrogen-powered planes being in place by 2035. We're already seeing, for instance, hydrogen-powered buses being rolled out. If we move
but
some of our transport provisions.
But the engines don't exist for them and all the stuff about sustainable
at the
fuel.
At the moment, that's correct, Mark, but we've got to look at investing in those technologies because the reality is, while we are going to have to look at alternatives, we don't have the benefit of, say, in continental Europe, where you can take a high-speed train from Paris to Berlin. That's not available to us. So as an island, we're going to continue to rely on air travel. Okay. That does present a challenge.
Complete disconnect between our climate action plan and building a new runway at Dublin Airport, because what this is doing is expanding an industry and promoting the expansion of an industry rather than looking at ways of reducing our emissions.
All right, we have to leave it there. My time is up. Thank you all very much for being here. We were talking about Robert Troy there for a good while, and it's worth saying that he did reaffirm that he's more than happy to answer questions from SIPO and the RTB have, and will of course give a full account in the Dáil on all of those matters if required once it returns midway through September. But that's it from us for today and indeed for the week. Today's programme was produced by Niamh Lyons, researched by Emma Cawley. Louise Kerr-Ross was our broadcast coordinator. Jamie Dáil was on sound today. Over now to Ronan Collins.